I'd like to begin by seeing if you can remember a story that I remembered as a kid. The Emperor's New Clothes. Do you remember that story? Okay. All right, now. Well, it says a little, that's part of the story. A man who ran around without any clothes on. Well, that sounds like a... Those of you who haven't heard it now should be somewhat interested.
The only one who told the truth was a kid.
Okay. So let's see if we can tell that story, and I'll just kind of go through. It starts out with a tailor, I believe. Okay. Now, what was the nature of this tailor? Somebody want to tell me something about this tailor?
He was a slick guy.
He was a slick guy. Okay.
But also had a reputation of being an excellent weaver.
Uh-huh. He had a reputation of being an excellent weaver. Okay.
Didn't know that.
Huh?
He didn't know for sure though. He just said he did.
Oh, but he'd already built that reputation.
So okay.
He was going to glide after that.
Okay, let's assume he has a reputation and for some reason. And so he came to this kingdom, and what was his purpose in coming there? What did he try to do?
Make the emperor a new suit of clothes.
The emperor a new suit of clothes, okay? So we have this tailor with a large reputation, a good reputation, coming to make a new suit of clothes for the emperor. Okay, and what was so special about this suit of clothes?
Whoever, and he said that they could see who was not suited to the office he had, because if he couldn't see the suit of clothes, then that person was not suited to the office that he had.
Okay, so this tailor came and said that he's going to make a beautiful set of clothes for the king. And people who are not suited to their position in society or their office will not be able to see it. Okay? Everybody, you know, remember that. That's a key to the story. If you in this society are not suited for your position, then you will not see this. If you're not acceptable, you're not up to snuff, you're not going to see these clothes. Okay? So then he proceeded to weave this beautiful garment.
Very expensive material.
Very expensive material. Okay. Somebody want to take the next step of that story. What happened then?
Different people came in to see it, and he would sort of tell them what they were supposed to see.
Oh, okay.
And so he would say, oh, they couldn't see it, but they were not going to admit it. They said, oh, my, yes, that is very beautiful.
Okay, that is very beautiful. Beautiful. So there's a lot of affirmation that it was beautiful. And then the emperor came in, of course, and he says the same thing to the emperor. Oh, it's beautiful. And, of course, the emperor, of course, oh, my, yes, it is beautiful. It is beautiful. Okay, so they're going to then have a parade, something like this. And part of this, the celebration and the parade, the emperor is going to wear this beautiful garment, this beautiful garment. And so the tailor helps on, put the cloak on the emperor. And of course, he isn't wearing anything. But of course, he's not willing to admit that. And so they take him out on his cart, or the book I had, he was on a throne that the people were holding up on poles, so he was sitting right up there. Okay? It was a big parade, big procession. To show off the emperor's new clothes. Okay, so then what happened in the parade? You
know, most of the people said, oh, they're absolutely gorgeous.
They said, oh, those clothes are just beautiful. Those clothes are just beautiful. Everybody was saying, you know, the clothes are beautiful, and the king's going down there. Until what happened?
A little child comes along and says, oh, look, the emperor hasn't got any clothes.
All right, so the little child comes up and says, the emperor hasn't got any clothes on. And then what happens?
I think then people finally begin to admit, didn't they? I saw that.
People started laughing. Yeah, then it was like a chain reaction. You know, oh, really? The emperor doesn't have any clothes on. And pretty soon everybody was saying this until the emperor himself began to realize that he had kind of made a fool of himself. And I suspect that the tailor... I don't know what version. It got out of there in a hurry. Okay. Now it suggests there, I want to use this for radical thought, because I suggest that the statement by the young person, the emperor isn't wearing any clothes, that was a radical statement at that time. Because it was an unreasonable statement, because everybody was saying the emperor is wearing beautiful clothes. That's what the community of people was saying. So it was unreasonable, because the reasonableness said, everybody was saying, the emperor's clothes are beautiful. But nobody was willing to really address the reality that the emperor wasn't wearing beautiful clothes, because they felt threatened in their own position. Okay? They would be criticized for this. And I suspect...
Did they know about that?
Oh, yes.
It
was well publicized. Everybody knew that, you know, we have to have that in the story. Yeah. Everybody knew in the story that if you somehow weren't competent in your position, that you wouldn't see these clothes. And so people didn't speak up for fear of being criticized as not being competent.
Maybe even some of them thought they were incompetent.
Oh, yes, I'm sure there were people who thought they were incompetent. That's true. But they certainly, even those people, certainly didn't want to speak up and say, oh, the emperor isn't wearing, I don't see any clothes, because then, of course, they would have been condemned. Okay, I think there's a lesson in this, in terms of what I see, in terms of radical thought. I think a society needs some radical thought, or else some absurdities are simply accepted as being reasonable. And in this case, the emperor going around without any clothes on, and it was accepted as reasonable to do this. And it was the reality that the emperor didn't have any clothes on was denied. It simply that reality was simply denied. And it took a child who really didn't have any high position to lose, and probably who didn't understand the reasonableness themselves, to go ahead and speak up and say, no, the emperor isn't. And then it kind of spread like a chain reaction, I suppose, until the emperor himself found out that he was rather embarrassed. And then, of course, the tailor had to skip out of town. And what happened is the society's reasonableness changed. Right, that was the significant part. It wasn't so much the significant part that the emperor went and put some clothes on. What happened is what had been previously reasonable and acceptable in that society changed. Now, I'd suggest that has a lot to do with our society today. There are probably a lot of things that are tremendously absurd in our society. But the way we talk, the reasonable way of going about explaining things, denies the absurdity, or discourages the exposure of the absurdity. And central to that is a fear of people being criticized as being incompetent. Right? I think that we get from the story. I think, however, there are some significantly different things in our society. First, that the problems and our absurdities are far more complex than the emperor riding around with any clothes on. They're extremely complex. But nevertheless, they still may be absurd. I think you find that behind some of the absurdities, you have rather large institutions, you know, that benefit from the very absurdities. And that makes it additionally difficult to go ahead and deal with those absurdities. But what the thesis I would like to offer and suggest to you now, or that the concept, is that when a society such as ours has as much technological power as ours is, and when a society has as much rapid change as we do, and so much communication, so it's very easy to spread out news such as, if you don't see the clothes, you're incompetent. It is very important for a society to nurture some radical thought to expose its own absurdities. Okay, it is important to actually nurture that. Okay, now the universities, I think, in some ways, that was one role that we usually ascribe to the universities. That here's a community, presumably of people who have some sort of competence, who can examine different problems in society. And the one reason and the only reason that I can see that we can justify tenure, okay, is so that they don't get so much afraid by the same kind of message that the people in the emperor's new clothes, the story, got, that you'll be criticized and fired for being incompetent because you came up with something that was very different than the accepted reasonableness. To me, that's the only justification, really, for tenure, is that people can go on out and say, hey, the emperor isn't wearing any new clothes. All right, they can do that and not worry about getting fired the next day. Okay, so, but I'd say that in general, and I'm just looking at it from my own experience, that the universities have failed and now are in deep trouble right now and are not fulfilling that role very well. And I'd like to just take a few reasons for that. First off, the universities are broken down into specialty disciplines, and the problems don't break into nice, neat little packages like that. And it turns out that the interdisciplinary studies, in general, fail. They fragment apart. And part of the reason is that the people in one discipline are afraid to jump over into someone else's discipline because they will be criticized for being incompetent. So we have, again, this story still coming through, still coming through. I'd also suggest that institutions tend to discourage radical thought. And I think that as a person rises in an institution to higher institutional levels, largely it's because they go along with the existing reasonableness. In other words, I think the institutional hierarchy tends to function as a selective process to eliminate and discourage those who may actually participate in radical thought. As an example, in the story of the emperor's new clothes, I think if the emperor had a committee appointed on clothes, that they would have concluded in very flowery language that the king's new clothes were extremely beautiful. Okay, I think that they would have probably done that. And so I'm a little bit, maybe I'm down on committees, but I think that would probably be true. So I think then the universities are in deep trouble. I think even in my area, which is research, which supposedly should be somewhat radical. I mean, why bother researching things you already know? I mean, you want to do research on things that maybe it's not that way, or you want to ask questions, and hopefully if it's kind of far out research, you want to, that's supposedly good. I think even in the area of research, we find that radical thought, or asking big questions, tends to be discouraged. What happens more often is that the research is geared to the institution which is funding the research, and there's a tendency to do that kind of research which will most encourage future funding. So I think that happens. All right, now I'd like to
say, don't you think too, even in the individual disciplines, I think this is in some ways more insidious. Remember how long they followed, oh heavens, what's the Greek that everybody worshipped? Starts with an A, Aristotle. Think of how long whatever Aristotle said, Block learned. Mm-hmm. Isn't this true?
Yeah, I probably is.
And so in the individual disciplines, if some very important person makes a major contribution, the individual disciplines are false.
Oh, yes. I think, you know, if there's some of you who have tried to publish something that's kind of far out in a journal, you find out it just won't even get published quite often. But yet we need that, or else just any old ideals will start coming out and you won't have any discipline at all. Right, so the radical thought cannot simply be people just kind of spouting off, well, this idea or that idea. There has to be a critical process, a critical review. The people who do come out with some radical idea have to be able to go ahead and defend that and do their homework. And they have to be able to go ahead and convince their peers, responsible peers, that indeed their thought is indeed better than the old one. So we need that. But I think what we're having in our society today, and probably many times, is that institutions tend to discourage that very kind of dialogue. They tend to discourage it not because they have examined the existing reasonableness and said it's really good, but institutions tend to support the status quo because generally that's the way they get their support. That's the way they get their support. So if I do a research project which criticizes the Environmental Protection Agency, in other words, I come out with something that's very contrary to some policy that they have, there's a tendency for that agency to respond negatively toward me, regardless of whether they think the work is good or not. Okay? Now, I'd like to have this go in to the discussion of the church, because I think the church has a radical tradition, certainly in the Bible, and I've asked John to talk on that a little bit. And I think in today's society, with rapidly changing problems and many problems that we have in this society, that the church is going to have to nurture responsible radical thought. But I would also suggest that the church, like every institution, including the university or whatever, tends to eliminate radical thought. I think that's a characteristic of most institutions. And I mean responsible radical thought. I don't mean people just going out and just tearing apart what you believe. I don't mean that. I mean a responsible kind of radical thought. So I'd like to go ahead and keep those two things in mind, because I'd like us to talk more about ourselves, because we are part of a church, rather than saying, well, somebody out there. So, John, would you want to add a few thoughts on radical thought in the Bible?
Okay. I'm eager, too, to hear a number of your different impressions and stories and ideas, too, from various disciplines and ways of life about how radical thought affects your work. We need to get into these issues about university life very seriously, and about church life and possibilities of radical thought. In your parishes or in institutions that you're involved in, perhaps we can ask the questions about how might institutional life in certain instances nurture radical thought and help radical thought to flower and affect as much of its life as possible, especially in the church. But Dave asked me a little while ago to think about radical thought in the Bible and to consider the prophets. I told him that I might consider the prophets, but I'd rather say something about Jesus. And so I'll just remind you about one thing concerning the prophet, and then say a few words about Jesus, and then hear your response and your own ideas. The first prophet, well, I thought of several prophets immediately, but the one that my mind came to quite quickly was the prophet of the exile. And we find a profound statements of radical thought and radical acceptance of Yahweh's message in the 40th through the 55th chapters of Isaiah. If you can ever take that hunk of Isaiah and zip through it in one sitting, you will be amazed. There will be rivers flowing through the desert so that the people can come home, so that the people of Israel can leave Babylon and come back to their home country. And a highway will be made straight. And even an anointed one will be Yahweh's chosen to lead the people to their own land. The anointed one is a Persian king, Cyrus. The Messiah. Anointed means Messiah in the Old Testament. And for Hebrews to sit around in Babylon and say, God's Messiah is where? Who? What? A Persian king! Was another instance of the prophet's radical thought. But this was looking to the future. And it was a radical promise for the people of Israel that, in fact, came into some kind of historical reality. The people did come back. Not everything was quite like they were expecting when they did. But at least this thrust of their return was fulfilled. Radical prophecy. Jesus, in the very same way, put his complete trust in something that was going to be happening and that people could just barely taste. And so I think that that may be where the structure of radical thought might lie.
We see an example in Christ, too, in the institutional church rebelling against that radical thought. Of his day.
Of him rebelling against the institution.
And the institution coming back against him.
Yes, yes, very much. And within his time, of course, it was religious, political institutions that were bound into each other, that were one. but during the last 10 years especially, there was a fad about claiming Jesus as to be a revolutionary that took a lot of different directions. And where there was rather insubstantial speculation on Jesus' ministry and life as a revolutionary. One of the books that I think was very shallow went in that direction that was popular. Many of you might have seen it or read it. It was Hugh Schofield's Passover Plot. And that came after some other very substantial research about Jesus' relation to the institutions of his time, as well as his whole message. And one that I think that is far more substantial that I don't agree with entirely was by a professor named Brandon, S.G.F. Brandon, considering Jesus in relation to the Zealot Party, a group of religious patriots who wanted to change the political situation in his time. But even Brandon, who wanted to identify Jesus as closely as possible with this religious revolutionary group, found that he couldn't complete it. And so the notion of Jesus being a political revolutionary as such was kind of washed out. His thought was far too radical for that, I think. It was a universal, not simply a political or religious revolution, but a universal revolution that God was bringing to his world, that Jesus was proclaiming as God's coming kingdom. And we can reflect on this a little bit, but I would like to hear more of your responses and ways that you consider your relationship to Jesus and your parishes insofar as you think that he may be related to radical thought and living and dying and rising.
I'd like to think maybe of something that you know. This doesn't have to be a response you have any response, but something that you might know that Christ said that in our own society would be considered very radical in terms of that society.
By radical, you mean it doesn't conform to the usual
That we might, and something that we might ourselves feel somewhat threatened by advocating. Okay, so having to do with money, he had some pretty radical thoughts. And I've been reading that in the Lord's Prayer, "Forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors," that actually meant, as we forgive our debtors, was actually forgiving people who owe us money. It wasn't
not forgiving them.
Yeah, it was actually the according to the book I just got in the bookstore, it actually meant wiping out financial debts that people have. He didn't even use the figurative language. Okay, anybody else want to say some more on that, the relationship of Christ to money and wealth?
That was the thing about this. Easier for a rich man to get through the eye of a camel, whatever.
A rich man to get through an eye of a camel?
You know that story. It's a tough day.
Fred took a radical step today, going up to climb
this
cloudy.
And the statement about not laying up stores for yourself on earth, you know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. There's some radical thought that is taking the verse like, greater things than I do will you do, and saying that one of the roles that Jesus had was that of demonstrating what the potential of mankind was, not just impressing people with, quote, supernatural acts. Mm-hmm. And this is, there's a theology growing around this.
Mm-hmm. And do you see that happening?
There are some, yes, who are getting turned on to that.
Mm-hmm. I mean, not only people reflecting on it, but do you actually sense greater things than these occurring as in the Christian community or in those who are a part of Christ's body, living as...
I think there are isolated examples. But I would say in general, that whole idea is not acceptable, considered by the church.
Yeah. Greater things than Christ himself.
That's what he said.
That's a surprise.
I think the verse that says, any man come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross and follow me, is a radical thought. In times of office, we're living in times when people want to affirm the goodness of the self, to do your thing. And I see Christianity as diametrically opposed to that thing, is self-denial. Like I'm saying, if you can't say no to yourself sometimes, you cannot be my disciple.
That fits in, I think, with what was raised concerning money, too. I mean, giving up possessions.
I'm picking up what he just said, too, is that some commentators will say that the context in which he said that was spoken to zealots, that the cross was really the cross, that in order to follow me, in terms of the universal context that John was talking about, that ultimately it would lead to your death. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because following me is no easy thing.
At least it may lead to your death.
Well, he said, will. Take up your cross and follow me. And then he goes on to that, that ultimately, that this is what's going to happen. That if you're going to take up your cross, that that's what you're going to be looking forward to. And then, of course, the whole Luke 4, 16 to 21, the Spirit of the Lord is upon me. Preach good news to the poor. To set at liberty those who are oppressed and imprisoned, preach good news to the poor. And then, having said that, they was too radical, because he says that it's beyond this community too that I'm going to do that. And then even the oppressed people want to throw him off a cliff. The first time he opens his mouth in the terms of his ministry.
The story of the Good Samaritan, I think, was a radical story at that time, because Samaritans, of course, were despised and looked down upon. Carol didn't Carol Hindley tell that story in the 50s and use or paraphrase it and use a communist as the Good Samaritan, something like that? I think I heard that someone told me that, which of course at that time was the height of the McCarthy era, which probably got the spirit of the story much better than using a Samaritan, and I don't think that the response was too good, though.
Is there any image that is appropriate for the Samaritan for us in the 70s? Or are we too lackadaisical in any of our dialectics?
That's a good question.
We all have our Samaritan.
Huh?
We all have our Samaritan. Republicans or whatever.
Can be what?
Republicans or whatever.
Scapegoats.
A white person being helped by a Negro, could that be a black?
I think in the South, in the 50s, that would have been. I think now, maybe not so much. Yeah.
Is it possible that when we, pick out passages about money, giving money away, or even talk about greater works, that might even be deflecting away from the primary issue when you think about just isolating a few words that say, follow me, and then you look at the path, you look at the ultimate suffering, you look at such a passage as the one that says, foxes have holes, birds have nests, but the Son of Man has no place to lay his head, that I think getting to the core of the matter, maybe it, really, I when he says, follow me, that he wasn't kidding. And we've kind of gotten into that sphere that you were talking about a little bit ago, that there's all sorts of reasons society will punish us, and we will put ourselves in a variety of positions of jeopardy if we dare to take that step.
Yes.
But I mean, we pretend.
We pretend, and I think we can participate in the kind of dialogue, again, the Emperor's New Clothes, My Aren't Those Clothes Beautiful, and we can actually use a lot of our church language to do that. We can actually, you know, Rick.
I'm just thinking that, you know, if the definition of follow me is dealt with just as Jesus dealt with the situations at that time, a lot of people say, well, I can follow that. But to deal with the way in which he challenged some of the assumptions, and to do that today, you know, to challenge the church authority, said, you know, the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath, I will help a man on a Sunday. He would take a goat or an ox out of the well, sort of thing.
Or even get food to eat.
Yeah, get food to eat, that sort of thing. But to challenge some of the, what have become the traditional assumptions, which means that the church has got to be constantly renewing. And using that radical thought theme, looking at itself in terms of, are we really following Christ in challenging some of those old assumptions or not?
Now, I made the statement that I felt institutions, and I included the church in that, maybe that was a little radical statement, but that they tend to discourage the radical thought. How do people feel about that?
You know, what occurred to me as we were bringing these up is, can you think of something that wasn't radical of Jesus?
I was just thinking that they're on that, almost everything I could think of.
But what happens? What do we do with his radical thought? For me, we tend to turn it into something that is non-radical bring it down to where we can make it fit.
How do we do that?
Well, we raise the questions about it for which we have answers rather than the questions that we don't have answers.
Oh, okay.
Exactly.
And I see us do
that's
this
a good...
as a clergyman, I see it at our pastoral conferences.
Oh, fill us in on pastoral conferences.
Any other contribution?
For me, pastoral conferences raise the questions for which we think we have answers and give nice, neat answers to those questions. And we usually have speakers from within our Lutheran circles who talk our language, who raise the same kinds of questions and give the same kinds of answers. And I'd like to see us have the guts to bring someone in who would shoot holes in everything we've got to say and really back us up against the walls so that we stand there speechless.
Do you think what Jesus said was so radical in the sense that the people had misinterpreted and what they were supposed to be doing at the time, they were doing the wrong thing, and that he was just saying back straight, and it wasn't really being a radical, but he was telling them how to do it and how they were supposed to be doing it instead of how they were doing it at the present time.
But I think that would be radical. I mean, if you say, you know, all right, let's try and keep this somehow train of thought. Jerry.
Another thought hit me. Again, can we really deal with the radical nature of the gospel in a step apart, like I just about said, what Dale did, you know, at our conferences or in this group or in that group or in another group. But I guess what I struggle with is that I need to come to terms. It isn't an institution out there that I better be primarily concerned about. Maybe I better be primarily concerned about, do I have the intestinal fortitude to look at that gospel and see what he said and say, I don't care what all of these deflective books or all of these rationalizations are about, but am I willing to do that radical thing?
But at the same time, you need, I mean, we can do a radical thing that that maybe doesn't mean anything. I mean, we may think it does at the time. I think the dialogue of peers, I think, is important, or the dialogue of other people who are concerned with that is important.
That's not what I'm saying.
But I think we need that too.
That's not what I'm saying. Okay. What I'm saying is that the tendency, just what you're talking about, and if we had the guts to bring somebody in, well, 100 miles from home at a conference, you may get just that kind of a speaker.
Okay.
And you can have a glorious time sitting around and talking about, man, did he really lay...
But you got to do something with it.
But the closer you get to home, and the closer you get to your own door...
I get you.
The more absurd it begins to seem.
Yeah.
I'm not saying we shouldn't discuss it. I'm just saying that I cannot blame the institution for what I am not willing to do.
Are you saying, can I phrase that in terms of the ministry? Because I've heard two things, that quite often when pastors get together, ministers get together at a conference, there tends to be a reinforcement of the old ways. Okay. And, okay,
or
so
university professors.
Or university professors or anyone else, okay? And then what you're saying is, even when someone goes out and raises something at the conference, which people say, aha, yes, that as you leave and come closer to the parish, it becomes more and more difficult for you to face bringing that there and doing something there with that at the parish level.
Okay. And I guess what I'm saying too is that as far as the parish and the clergy is concerned, you almost draw an analogy there that or a parallel that all Uncle Toms are not black.
Yeah, right.
Okay.
I think maybe we haven't really faced up to the main thing about why that we're afraid. And I think I'm going back to university again.
Mm-hmm.
Now, why is the university afraid? It's today the position of the university financially is very bad.
Mm-hmm.
And anybody that has any responsibility for the administration of the university is going to be very concerned about anything that is going to make the financial position worse.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Now, I think exactly the same thing in a way is true of the individual person. Most of us, in one way or another, have so many fears within ourselves of what others may think of us, especially those people who mean much to us, how they will regard our actions or thoughts or something like that, that really prevents us from having freedom.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that really is maybe more a problem than, you know, whether new ideas are coming to us or something.
Mm-hmm. It's the fear of being rejected and possibly financially rejected. Okay.
I think what's also related to that too is the use that the institution or the way in which the institution relates to that individual who does, you know, speak out or say something. And to me, that's where the really frightening kind of thing I think can happen is seeing someone as a symbol of that, and therefore in some way trying to negate, you know, what that person has to say. And so you know, it's like, wow, then we can really put our finger on that person becoming a symbol. I guess that, you know, as a woman pastor and theologian, at times I feel that I get put in that symbolic position. So, well, it's Karen's crazy viewpoint, so, you know, it's not all women pastors that are thinking that, but this or that, and therefore it's easier to deal with if you can just say that it's this person who's espousing that, mm-hmm. rather than...
You isolate the person somewhere.
Yep. Well, the other way it gets diffused is that what saddens me is trying to find a balance between viable process,
mm-hmm.
so that you don't just get inundated with radical thought, but also being able to hear radical thought, because I have seen so often someone come with something really important or in the church to say, and by the time it has gone through committees, it has been so watered down that it's totally irrecognizable. And the impact of the initial statement is lost.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Okay. Isn't it just normal, though? I mean, if you know this person's going to come up to you and disagree with everything you say and shoot you down and tell you're a liar, you know, isn't it just normal for a person to stand through that person?
I don't
pick,
think...
Instead pick on this person that's going to give you positive reinforcement.
But I don't think radical thought necessarily has to say, well, you're a liar. I don't think it has to do that. In fact, quite often radical thought may affirm you, but it may also threaten. If you were to say it, you may feel threatened, as I think you had said. But I think there is a natural tendency to, when someone appears to challenge your beliefs, to be afraid. Be afraid.
Yeah, I'd like to share something about follow up. Is that the congregation I serve in Oakland is all black, and that in itself is unique within the Lutheran Church. And our congregation and another predominantly black congregation in Oakland brought a resolution to our convention in Los Angeles in April, which was to collect money and to send medical supplies to the freedom fighters in Namibia and Southwest Africa. And people were frightened of that resolution. And of course you have to go through committee. And the obvious is to take it, well, the only way is to the Committee on Reference and Counsel, right, which is a committee of all white, with the exception of one person, suburban people, and they became very fearful of that. So fearful, in fact, that Bob Marshall, who is the president of the LCA, was called in to consult on that resolution, because it was, in a sense, going underground. We had a supply to do that. I had connection to get these medical supplies to the people who were dying and getting the hell kicked out of them. And so on the floor of the convention, Bob Marshall says, and I think this is where radical thought meets opposition, the Lutheran Church does not break the law. As we will not smuggle Bibles to the Soviet Union, we do not break the law. Which heard in the convention ears' eyes, when this resolution comes up, we will not support them. So finally, it got watered down in spite of the drought in California to say, okay, we won't send it through illegitimate channel, but we'll send it through Lutheran World Federation, which can do something. And we agreed to that resolution. And that was printed. And then at the last moment, when that resolution was read on the convention floor, the Committee in Reference and Counsel had agreed in secret to delete that portion of the resolution. So Lutherans just voted to send money. Which I think is what happens when you have to deal with something that is radical, that may be illegal, but probably because you didn't know anything about it. Mm-hmm. And obviously, unless somebody's had their head buried underneath a rock, Namibia and South Africa have been very prominent in Lutheran news because there are so many Lutherans there. Mm-hmm. But the return of that was that our people, at my congregation and Kent's congregation, were very incensed as to what the Lutheran Church really means by justice.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I wonder what they thought about the law that South Africa is breaking all the time to keep that country.
Right. Well, that's
against the law for them to be there to start
with. Right. But that issue wasn't raised. The issue was raised that the Lutheran Church does not break the law, and Bob Marshall had a peculiar problem. If he was going to Tanzania, and if one of his friends starts sending things to Africa, the New York Times will pick that up. So will the Los Angeles Times, and all of a sudden he's going to have the government on his head in terms of the tax problems with the church. So that's his problem too, as you were saying before, financial. And so until we as an institution can deal with some of these forces, I think increasingly we're going to have to deal with, at least in our cities, because some of our people are not going to sit back and kowtow some of our own, you know, white middle class fears of breaking laws, that we're going to remain a white middle class church. Mm-hmm. And I think that's tragic.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, yes.
I was going to raise the question. Doesn't this all go back to a more basic question? Are we really convinced that Christianity is true?
Could be.
I run a bookstore, and I run into a lot of people who say, it's true for me. Kind of a relativistic thing. Do we really believe that if we save our life, we lose it? And that's the question,
that's
being radical. Do we really believe that?
Do we really believe if we save our life, we lose it? That's a good question.
That's
my own.
Yeah. If we're really convinced of that, yeah, then we won't flinch one ounce about being radical, because we die if we don't.
That's right.
Okay.
Why is Paul so screwy and running around the Roman Empire like a nut? Yeah. He was convinced Christianity was true, and you couldn't stop him.
It's like the woman over here says that, the fellow could say, and Jesus could say to the fellow, to sell all you have, give it to the poor, and follow me. Well, I think he did the first two. That was, but the following, that was where the hang up was. The fellow could say, and Jesus could say to the fellow, to sell all you have, give it to the poor, and follow me. Well, I think he did the first two. That was, but the following, that was where the hang up was. Because he could see where that was going to lead. And it gets back to what the guy was saying tonight, is the fear of death, the fear of what's going to happen.
So you know,
all we have is give it to the poor, but we're not going to go any step farther.
You know, on your convention floor, did anyone challenge that final resolution?
Oh, yeah. It narrowly was defeated, surprisingly. It got defeated by 20 votes. And people were incensed, I think, at some of the comments that were made, because also at that convention it came out that the LCA pension fund is heavily invested in South Africa and Namibia.
That's cool.
And people challenged that, and Bob Marshall didn't have a good answer for it other than, well, what did we do, stop the world and get off? Mm-hmm. And it was that kind of biting cynicism that went on, but it was challenged. But I think the weight of it was that we don't want to break the law, kind of thing.
You know,
and you see that as a cop-out?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. You know, I don't know if you call it a cop-out or not. Mm-hmm. One of the most, shocking things that happened to me is when I was made head of the department for a while, and while my department head was on a leave of absence. Many of the things that I had criticized in that department head, I immediately found myself doing. I tell you, you know, you have no idea how it changes your outlook on life when you become in a position of major responsibility in administration. And I wonder if I was the same person, really.
I wondered about that when you said that, too, because you can always argue the opposite point of view, that if you become too radical, then you may sort of blow your situation to ever become effective to institute any other change. I mean, if you end up breaking the law and ending up in jail or losing the position, then you may never be able to institute the change that you might have done. I mean, I know that can sound like a cop-up, and sometimes it is, but I'm not sure it always is. It's not a black and white kind of an issue that you can always take the radical viewpoint.
That's really a black and white kind of issue for the people who aren't suffering. But for the people who are suffering, it becomes a very black.
For the people that aren't suffering.
I mean, for the people who
are suffering,
it becomes a very black and white.
It becomes a cop out if the principle is we don't break the law.
Yeah. Then it becomes a cop out.
Everything, then it's a cop out.
I see. If that settles everything, yeah. Well, that goes down to that whole issue of civil disobedience in it too, doesn't it? I mean, that's.
I think
if people were that would get that money, they might actually fight.
Well, it was the people who were doing the fighting.
Yeah.
It's not only the money,
but the people
needing the medical supplies.
What law was this breaking? I didn't follow.
Well, that you're going.
Mm-hmm. Not
through the official. You're not going through the official channels, and you're dealing with a political group in Namibia and South Africa who is the guerrilla warfare.
What law is against that? There were Americans that donated.
Except the American government recognizes,
We recognize the government.
There's probably some South African laws against it, I would guess.
I wouldn't worry about breaking South African laws, but
we could throw into a chaos the Lutheran World Assembly if that happened.
Well, why would it be
to take place 2 weeks later?
I don't understand why it would be all right for the Lutheran World Federation to do it, but not for the.
Well, because then the Lutheran World Federation is a recognized channel of the Lutheran Church, and it wouldn't go to the guerrilla people. It would go to very.
Oh, you mean the Lutheran World Federation would only support South Africa? I thought the Lutheran World Federation
would support the people who are hurting, but it wouldn't be the people who are doing the fighting. Because therefore, the Lutheran World Federation would really lose some support.
Well, Well, all I can say is it sounds like that's a very complicated issue, and it's very, I think that it's a really tough issue for somebody to try and decide on. I mean, whether, I don't know. I don't understand that issue at all. I know nothing about NIMBY.
Okay,
I mean, you know, and
Lauren.
I imagine a lot of other people convention.
This was touched on before, but I just wonder, does everybody think that the Lutheran Church, is, or the Christian Church as it stands today, considers the New Testament radical? Or does it consider it normal for them?
Good question. I think it's the same question that this gentleman back here was raising, and we just got a little tiny bit of an answer. And we need a lot more reflection on that. Weren't you hoping that we would answer a little bit more of your
question? Well, it went along with what he said, too, you know, bringing somebody from the outside. You know, we'd be looking at the pastors all get together, and they look at, they reconfirm each other. But if you bring in somebody else, you know, they may say you're doing it all wrong. You call him a radical. But really, a radical, you can call him radical, so I guess that's a definition. But when you're supposed to be doing something in a certain way and you're not doing it, you're the radicals because you've changed it.
Now, there might be another way of going about that business that might... you know, actually, if the people, all the people, now you were just saying you didn't even know anything about all this problem in Southwest Africa. Now that's terrible.
In
the Lutheran Church, the people are so ignorant about the... Excuse me.
Very.
He can take it.
Was given to South Africa.
That I know, dear, but I don't know what she's talking about, all these gorillas and people going back and forth. I realize that there's a country there in the kind of the jurisdiction of South Africa.
Not real gorillas.
The laity has to be made aware of the problem. If the laity were sufficiently aware of the problem, Bob Marshall wouldn't have to be afraid of what he says.
And
that
gets back to the pastors are not very...
Yeah, but how many problems can everybody be concerned about all over the whole world? That's the point, too. I would like to make another issue. Is I think that the issue of radical, when you're talking about this thing, the question back here, I wish Jim Burtness was here, but I think we're operating under many different definitions of what is radical. And I think that's part of our confusion here. Yeah. What do you really mean by radical?
Well,
is it really something that's...
Do we need a real definition, though?
Well, I think you do, because we're not talking common language here.
Burtness would probably say what to mean radical is to confess Jesus Christ as your Lord, like the Confessing Church did in Germany, and to take a stand against Hitler.
But that's not the only way it's radical. I mean, that's what he said, Paul. Why, you know, is it never normal?
It seems to me that...
To radicals, do
that. All right, you go first.
Were they breaking the law when
he said that? Rather than work. Maybe we need to get back to defining radical. But
what I hear being said is that we need to take the reality of an institution and work with it. And part of what I hear you saying is everyone can't necessarily agree with every radical thought or idea or need or so forth. What we need then is to say that the radical nature of the gospel is an essential part of the church. But so our institution needs to somehow structure a way in which it can deal with its radicalness as well as its ongoing function.
Yes.
Okay, good.
And
so that administrators aren't so much in the position like you were saying.
That's the good question.
Because that was a good point. I mean, very important.
We've got to run the ship somehow, and we've got to deal with what we can agree on.
Mm-hmm.
And so somehow we need to make room for the radical dimension so it can happen. Now, maybe it's a smaller group that decides to do
it. I think Bob Marshall would say that. To be fair to him, I think he would say, that's not a resolution in that way to bring to this convention floor, but do it.
Yes.
But do it. Yeah.
Because if we get caught doing that, we're really going to get the hell kicked out of us as an institution. But do it. And but that word could have been communicated by him, I think, to the people who originally brought the resolution.
Yeah.
As it was, it's very difficult now for white clergy to communicate that to black people. Because when Bob Marshall speaks, he speaks for the Lutheran Church. And it's difficult then for the historian, 20 or so years from now, when it comes across that convention proceedings, say what was really going on, because Bob Marshall would say those things in private.
But
but there may be certain radicals who won't settle for a private word like that.
That's right.
There's a certain position that wants to press everything up against the wall.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and that's
and the difficulty of being in a position of an institution who has to worry whether we're going to have to start paying taxes or not is that we've got to tread lightly. And I think this is one of the ambiguities in this situation. You know, we want to be an institution and such like, but we all don't want to, you know, for instance, pay taxes. And as long as we're going to, you know, try to walk that tightrope, then these problems are not going to be any easier. Not that that'll solve it.
That's why Stringfellow thinks that all churches ought to start paying taxes, so we have freedom to do our thing.
Right. That could be, yeah.
Still wouldn't be free to break the law, though.
No. No.
And but Jesus, they give unto Caesar that which is
Caesar's.
It also said we must serve man rather than Caesar, too, in response to this.
They should make the law abridging the establishment of religion. It's also in our Constitution.
Lauren.
Yeah, can I also say that in my job, you know, there are which is in engineering, there have been many people come and go that have been radicals. And
in engineering?
Yeah. In that they don't follow the norm of the paperwork, or they don't follow the norm of the progress that's being made, but they go off on their own and try to explore a completely different avenue. Hmm. And all except for one case, they end up completely wasting their time. And the guy that has it is a complete genius, or he's very smart enough. Mm-hmm. And he can do that because he's a genius. But it seems like if a person should be a radical, at least you don't know what he's doing.
Right? That's right. You have to do it. I agree with that. I mean,
yeah, you're saying being responsible.
I think a responsible radicalism, right. I think maybe Dale got on that a little bit in terms of structuring the institution. We just don't want people going off and spouting off. I mean, there has to be some responsibility. But at the same time, we have to recognize the nature of institutions and the particular positions that administrators get into and how they change their outlooks and maybe restructure the institution to recognize those limitations.
Maybe to make it something we have all in common. What would that look like in a congregation? How could a congregation make room for radical thought and some kind of action in radical thought?
Okay, there's a question.
How could they make room for it?
Yeah.
How could it work in your congregation?
I like the concept of making room for it because it doesn't necessarily say accept radical thought. Right, you make room for it, and that radical thought may take over if it proves out. But the danger is not making any room for it, so then nothing gets challenged, like in the story of the Emperor's New Clothes, not letting any of the kids say anything. I mean, nothing would happen.
Happened to you in some of your congregations that we've always done, this is in a very minor way, but just say, we've always done something a certain way, and somebody says, well, you know how? What would you think if we do this? Oh no, no, we don't do it that way. You know what
I mean? We tried it once.
We tried it
once. It doesn't give up. Uh-huh. And works the right kind of way. I'll bet you that in about 5 years you'll be doing it in your church if it's really a good idea.
Unless they refer to a committee.
Well, see, that's the point about radical. See, in one church, Dale, it might be radical to suggest that you take communion from a common cup. Mm-hmm. Or it's very radical to suggest you have communion with bread and not with wafers. I mean, everyone knows it has to be a wafer because it's unleavened bread. I mean, on the other hand, you know, it can be everything from throwing all your collection money to the poor
to
South
for
Africa or whatever. That can be very radical in a different church.
So whatever's radical in a congregation, how can it make room for that? Now, how can we get these ideas and roll them around and test them and chew on them and not expect everybody to jump on a bandwagon until there's been time to deal with them?
But isn't that, go back, I was thinking of the example earlier, too, when you're talking about institutions and universities, about like the Missouri Synod question thing. I mean, in terms of, you know, what happened at Concordia Seminary in terms of being radical on the one sense, that was radical on the one, for today, to have a university faculty to not have academic freedom, or to take a stand that's what would be considered a very conservative point of view could be interpreted as being radical from the way you guys were using the word.
But I don't think that's what Dale's addressing there.
No, not that he was addressing there, but it brought it back to my mind again, and I'm still very concerned about that, because I think it goes back to the issue raised before. It's a little off the subject of the congregation, but
I think
as to the universities and what is the role of a radical function in a university, because I see a similar problem happening in other universities, secular universities as well as that, in terms of saying, hey, we're only going to take on faculty or whatever, teach courses that are productive of jobs. That's what basically everybody's after, because that, you know, taxpayers are supporting the institutions through the legislatures, and they want people to turn out products that are employers to, for traditional roles and jobs. And that's all they're interested in. They're not interested in supporting universities that come up with ideas, okay, and new ideas that are, you know, different ideas. That's what Concordia said. That's what the course said.
I still like to come back to Dale's point, because the same thing operates in the university as what Dale's asking. I've been running it through my mind, Dale. And the frustration I've had with my parish is that we never get past the damn committees. It dies there. It never gets to a place where the whole congregation gets to experiment with it, you know.
Or even a part of it.
Well, then why not do it without the committee? Why can't you do it?
Because in the LCA, it's right process. I mean, we all know it has to be right process, and it just never gets passed. But the question of language, as a woman, I have a big investment in that. It's never gotten past the worship and music committee, and it's like the two of us that are interested in just
what language? I mean, about
using
women?
Inclusive language instead of everything as being man and he.
Well, we did that in our church, but there never went through committee. They just wrote the songs that way. It's all Christian people rejoice. That's what you say.
Okay, what,
nobody voted on it.
What about, you know, committee of the whole? Where? What about a forum? The kind of thing that we talked the other night that Holden offers for us is that we have one base, which is the gospel of Jesus Christ, and then, you know, if you take the people that are here, we go off in all directions, and the one thing that we have in common is that belief and that faith in Jesus Christ. But we can come and talk together because we do have that thing.
Mm-hmm. So in that case, we have kind of a niche within the church.
Yeah.
Holden is kind of a niche where that is accepted.
Yeah, but is that a possible, you know, is that something that could be structured in a congregation?
That's right.
You know,
that goes back to the life of the church. You know, maybe in many of our congregations, we don't share that faith.
Yeah,
and we think that what we share are cultural and political homogeneities of different kinds.
Oh, wow.
Radical.
Woo, that's a good one. So that we're really getting together, not so much out of Christian faith, but out of cultural similarities, kind of a social...
Yeah, we like to forget that.
Well, that would reflect...
Yeah, well, certainly, Lutheran Church is Church of Law and Order.
And Scandinavians and Germans.
Right, and we can't have a resolution, it's going to scare the hell out of it.
No wonder it. Yes.
It seems to me that one of the first things that's going to happen for, in order for a congregation to be open to radical possibilities, is that laymen are going to have to become better instructed lay persons, or have to become better instructed theologically.
I
run this constantly in my bookstore. Laymen don't know schmucks. They got a bundle of rags and tags of humanism and a bunch of crazy mixed up ideas, and they call that Christian faith. And they've been sitting in the pew their whole life. Now, I'm not criticizing you folks, I'm not a Lutheran, I'm not even talking about Lutherans, but I have a hunch that we're all in this together as far as laymen not understanding Christianity. It's right.
How can that happen?
Pastors have got to become convinced that theology is important.
Never. if you put the responsibility for real creative activity and theological reflection among lay people on the backs of pastors, you won't get past that point.
Okay, I'll refer here to Luther.
Won't get past it.
In the preface to I'm not sure if it's shorter or his longer catechism, he makes a statement somewhat that goes, he's just been traveling in the country and he's been talking to the common people, and they are ignorant theologically. He says, you must instruct these people. You must tell them to come to instruction. If they don't come, tell them they are not Christians. Tell their bosses not to give them any wages for food. And further, tell them that the emperor is disposed to banish them from the empire.
It's really hard to buck Luther then, but...
he's your man.
That creativity starts when you start where a person is at. And when you give a person a chance to give out where he is at, what his idea is, and show some interest in what he has to offer, then help him see that he could probably gain something and expand that idea by moving into theology. I agree with the need that you're saying.
I'm
concerned that we don't say lay people can't do it unless they have a theology, and they've got to go through these steps before they can share a radical thought. I'd rather start with where the people are and show interest in them and get them turned on, and I think they will then study theology.
I talked to some people earlier this week who belong to a congregation in Southern Oregon, and I'm familiar with it. And it's a congregation of really committed people. You don't get in it unless you're really committed. And one of the ways that this couple said is that they had to beg their pastor to have an instruction class. Mm-hmm. And he said, okay, you set up the time and the place and come with the questions you want answered. Well, those people that belong to that church know what it's about. It's not large, but it's powerful.
Mm-hmm. Okay, you right over here.
Yeah. But the preachers have been preaching down at us for so long. They've been preaching at us. I don't believe that's a means of learning anymore. And especially probably in this day and age, when you see a Nixon fall, all these experts, these great theologians and great politicians, they're all falling down. What is the common person supposed to do? Where is his expertise? So I think it goes back to what Dale has said. I think it's got to be a process of learning together, and then we can start learning again, but not by this speaking down to us.
Okay, I think that's a good point.
Do you think, though, that a fair amount of pastors, what you said, Ricky, are actually threatened by...
Mm-hmm. Sure they are. Yeah. I think they are, too.
Yeah, that's what I would think. That's true, too. I mean, they're not very anxious to enter into theological dialogue with their congregation.
Why are we hesitant, though, to assume a strong role of leadership? You know, I see Christ in the New Testament as teaching and teaching and teaching and teaching. Mm-hmm. Now, isn't that what we're up to? If we understand, and use a variety of ways to teach.
But I think the minister in most churches now has a whole lot of other social functions that have been assigned the church, you know, and there's just a whole bag of those things. And also the ministers are part of an institutional framework which Christ wasn't, and I think that makes a difference.
It's a good point, but how did Christ teach? You know, Christ didn't teach by entering into the
theological dialogue.
You know, he really taught either by example or by parable and story, like maybe like a verb or something. I mean, it was mystical. It was hard to understand. It was confusing. It was radical.
People didn't understand.
That's right. We're still talking about it later, but we're talking too much in terms of study. How come we can't talk, and maybe we need to paraphrase those things into similar language today, into similar modern language?
I would like to hear what you want to hear. I want to hear you tell me what you want to hear.
As a pastor.
As a pastor.
Okay.
Oh, boy.
I would need a faith communicated in a vibrant way, first of all.
I want to hear the gospel preached like the preacher really believes it and it really matters.
I think, you know, what Dale said, and this relates, I think, to your question for me, is that he said, you know, we have to be listening to people. And that, you know, if we were really to do that, that is, you know, somebody says, is the gospel radical? Well, it's radical because it goes against everything I want to do to organize the world my way, really listen to somebody else, which means that I'm at their feet in a sense. They become a controlling thing. They become God to me in a sense when I listen to somebody. And I think a pastor performs a very valuable and important service when he or she becomes a person who's permitting us to listen to them and to enter in, you know, on that side of it. Like when I hear a pastor preach and he's both talking maybe to me as sort of an object, and at the same time I realize that I'm also on the other end of it. That the word is for me, and it, but, it can, but I could be there too. I mean, the pastor stands there in my place. So I need to hear about myself, and I need to be put in the context. I need to be invited in myself. And the gospel, I find, does that. People who perhaps don't understand it can, I think, you know, go over their heads because it's greater than we are. You know, but I think to do that, you have to, when you get up in the pulpit, I've done it a few times, and sometimes, you know, I feel like I'm in really deep water, and I say, Lord, you better be holding on, because at this particular time, I'm not too sure where I am. It's a risky enterprise. Carol Hinderly used to say that a preacher has to get up in the pulpit and run naked. You know, you drop everything at best. You drop everything and you just sort of, you know, you launch out.
Well, Carol Hinderly is absolutely correct.
Yeah.
But try this on now. Would you say then that the job of proclamation on the part of a pastor or a layman in the pulpit, either one, is the communication of a of the gospel in the radical sense of follow me, and a proclamation that leads in that direction, that takes the ethic of the New Testament, the life of Jesus, they take seriously the things that St. Paul said, the other epistle writers, and challenges the congregation to live that radical life.
I wouldn't put it that way. I think a pastor has to show me that I'm already there. He's got to show me that as black as I am, you know, as badly as I'm doing the things I already know that I should be doing and I'm not doing, that I'm already there. That the invitation comes to me somewhere inside of all that, or beside it, or in spite of it, or because of it, or whatever. The invitation is to me, as black as I am. Then I feel like I've been preached to, and that happens. Because I feel like, you know, God is inviting me in.
Let's go over to Dale over here.
That's great.
Right.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Dale, go ahead.
Yeah, I'd like the pastor who would equip the parishioners of his congregation to carry on the ministry of the church.
Yeah.
Amen. Let me ask one more question, and that is, do you believe that a pastor can preach the gospel without getting himself in trouble?
Probably not.
Wow.
Okay, we've gone till 10:30, and I'm certainly not going to cut off any discussion. I have particularly enjoyed here those of you in the ministry who have been very honest in terms of your positions and of your comment of what it's like to be in an administrative position. And the different experiences that I see that the people have here, I've been very appreciative of that. And of course, the discussion can continue. I think there have been some very good questions raised. I particularly like Dale's question, how can within the parish there be room for radical thought? And I like that way of saying it. Okay? Okay, I'll end the official session now, and anyone can do whatever.